Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we'll be speaking with Susan Hennessy, a fellow in National Security in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institute and the Managing Editor of Lawfare. And we're talking to her about cross-border law enforcement in the internet age. We hear a lot of people in the InfoSec community expressing some discomfort with the FBI's use of the so-called network investigative techniques that are designed to decloak Tor users. Susan pops by to explain why the FBI and other law enforcement bodies aren't too concerned about the international ramifications of dropping decloaking technique on the whole planet. We also cover off a few of the other issues around how data can be turned over to various governments. It's a fascinating chat, and it is coming up after the news. This week's show is brought to you by Tenable Security, and in this week's sponsor slot, we'll hear from Ray Comer, Tenable's VP of Technical Alliances. And we're talking to Ray about a partnership Tenable has formed with Siemens. They're trying to tackle the issue of tracking vulnerabilities in industrial control system equipment. But as you'll hear, people aren't actually buying it so much for the vuln tracking side. They're buying it for the visibility component. It turns out dropping a passive scanner on your ICS network is a good way to actually know what is on your ICS network. That is a fun one, and it is coming up a little bit later on. But before all of that, it is time, of course, for a check of the news headlines with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, you know, the New York Times ran a big report saying that Uber had been owned and paid hush money and covered it all up, and it's, you know, a big scandal.
Yeah, it certainly has broken pretty big over the last few days. I mean, a lot of people have been worrying about the impact of the data breach itself. I mean, some 50 million users and details of 600,000 drivers, including apparently scans of driver's licenses and other things like that. So some, you know, reasonable potential for impact to Uber drivers. But then, of course, yeah, the story about it being the breach goes back to, what, 2016, and it being covered up and hackers being paid ransom money, and that's certainly grabbed attention. And we've seen rather a lot of column inches, I guess, expressed on that subject.
Yeah, we have. And I've done some digging on this one, and I feel like I've got a bit of a better grip on it than some of the more mainstream reports. Look, what it looks like happened here is someone did indeed get in touch, you know, holding a big bag of Uber's data. And they said, you know, give us money. And Uber did, right? Like that is not disputed. They paid $100,000 through HackerOne, through Bitcoin. But through that process, they were actually able to identify him. Now, what I believe happened then is they went to legal and they were saying, look, if this person signs an NDA, which, you know, specifies that the data is destroyed, we're pretty confident that that has actually been destroyed and we'll keep an eye out for the data. But if it doesn't pop up on the internet, is it a breach? It's like the whole tree falling in the woods metaphor, you know? It's the breach in the woods. So, look, I think the decision was kind of bizarre. You know, the decision not to disclose was quite bizarre because, you know, really you could have spun this into not a great story, but at least a less damaging one than the way it's being presented now. There's a couple of other interesting factors to this. I've spoken to multiple sources who say that this person who came forward with the data had no idea what the information security industry was, didn't even know that bug bounties existed. They paid the guy so that they could get their data back, work out what the impact was, and sort of remediate, right? So they paid first, ID'd him later, got him to sign up through HackerOne through legit, you know, personal details so that they could have some leverage. So if the data did pop up, obviously they'd you know, wind up in cuffs. So, you know, that's maybe where some of the confidence about the data not being, you know, further leaked came from. I also believe that they may have done some forensics on this guy's kit. So, you know, there's a lot of factors in here that didn't make it into the mainstream reporting, including, and this is just something that I've heard, that this guy has actually targeted other companies as well, who, by the sounds of things, haven't disclosed anything either. Further, I think this might have a little bit to do with internal politics at Uber because, you know, former CEO Travis is still on the board, I believe running the board and appointing his mates to the board. And we got a new CEO, and I think there's a bit of a power struggle there. But the really interesting question that this brings up for me, Adam, is this seems like a very similar situation to a bug bounty participant going out of scope. You know, if a bug bounty participant goes out of scope, downloads a bunch of PII, what do you do then? Do you disclose it?
Well, that is a very good question. And obviously we've seen a bunch of cases where bug bounty kids have gotten the little carried away and have gotten that escape. Or even, you know, you can do it by accident, right? If you pull data and you don't know what you're getting until you unpack it. It is a very good question. And obviously then there's also the, like, when you sign up to a bug bounty program and you've read the sort of the rules of engagement for the target that you're working on, I guess it's a little bit different to when you're signing up after the fact. That's a little bit, maybe a little bit more clear in that it was well out of scope. But yeah, it is a very good thing. Like, what are you supposed to do? I mean, obviously, in pen testing engagements, you know, we come across, what would otherwise be breach data all the time. But because we're covered by existing NDAs and contractual structures, it's not treated like it's a breach, even though, you know, in some cases, we in our work might exfil data, as part of our stuff that, you know, people would reasonably consider a breach were it any other circumstance. So yeah, no, it's quite a good question. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I think the fact that this attacker was a complete numpty is almost a bit of a mitigating factor here. Someone's come along, with all this data going, you know, give me money. And they had no knowledge that there was a different way to sort of monetize their skill here. So I think some people in Uber sort of saw this whole experience as trying to steer this person towards, you know, a more legitimate career. Right?
Which, I mean, I guess that's an admirable goal, perhaps. It's certainly a funny circumstance. And yeah, you're right. Like, this nuance certainly wasn't across the mainstream reporting, and the interaction with the bug bounty programs and stuff was not a thing. Well, I guess if you're outside the industry, like, you don't have the necessary context to really, understand what's going on with that. But yeah, it's certainly not playing out well for Uber, which, you know, in general is having a pretty rough time of things, I guess, because they're kind of jerks. But yeah,
you'd think a phone call to a regulator would make sense in this situation, right? And you can guarantee now that the FBI knows this transaction exists, and they know that Uber know who the attacker is, that this person's going to get a visit for from the FBI now, right? Like, if I were them, I'd be taking my bitcoins and using them to buy a one-way ticket to Belize.
Yeah, exactly. Pull out John McAfee. It's probably our advice to you if you're listening, whoever you are, guy. Sorry, Pat, called you numpty. But yeah, we're seeing some interest, I guess, in the process of – there was an existing investigation going on about a previous breach at Uber, and whether or not they had, like, just not mentioned this one in that process. We've seen some leverage being applied by some senators from the US government asking them, you know, for some please explains. It's a whole thing is just a complete mess.
Yeah, I think this could have been handled at the time. And I just think the decision not to disclose this, or at least to contact the regulator and say, look, we think we've got this situation under control. We just paid the guy, but now we know who he is. We've got him to sign an NDA. We've had a look at his devices. The data is gone. So, I mean, that might have been a manageable situation. And you got to remember, too, at the time, like, Uber was just embroiled in about 10 simultaneous scandals. So I think that would have factored very heavily in the decision not to disclose this. I think they made a mistake, personally. I mean, it might sound like I'm being a little bit defensive of them. I guess I'm just trying to paint a more complete picture of what may have happened there, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, certainly the way that it has broken now is not good for them or the person who, you know, I was going to use the word found, I guess they didn't really find it, like helped themselves to, you know, via some keys nicked from GitHub, the data.
But I mean, this was a private Git as well. Like, this wasn't, they didn't just find some AWS bucket keys, because I think that's what it was. It was like AWS access keys, but maybe not buckets, but yeah, that's how they got it. They broke into like a private Git repository, which you'd think, why aren't you using two-factor for that? That's the real shame here, Adam.
Indeed, no 2FA on the GitHub. And then I guess obviously the creds that they were using or the tokens they had for AWS weren't adequately restricted either. So yes, least privilege is a thing you should be doing. Multi-factor is a thing you should be doing when you run a global corp.
Mm-hmm. I think we can safely say that it was a really dumb thing not
yes,
to disclose it.
Agreed, dumb.
Key takeaway there. In other news, which just broke this morning, which is just, you know, fabulous news, real comedy bug here. They're using the Metal Storm technique for getting root, which is to apparently mash the keyboard. How's this Mac OS root bug? Like, can you just walk people through it for people who might not have heard of it yet?
Oh, God. All right. So Mac OS High Sierra, the most recent release of OS X, has some issue with authenticating the root account. And in particular, if you are sitting at a prompt where it is asking you for the root account, we're asking you to authenticate, you can supply a username, and you supply the user root and an empty password, and you hit enter, you know, or click proceed or whatever, and it'll say no, and do it a few more times, and it might just let you in anyway.
Now, I understand that you have to do that through like system settings and users and stuff, but you can do it at a command prompt as well. I didn't hear that.
So there's a bunch of people have been finding a bunch of different ways you can do it. We've seen some people do it at the lock screen, at the login prompt. We've seen people do it via the remote desktop server. So if you have that turned on, and you don't have a root password configured and the root account is disabled, then this does work remotely via the Apple remote desktop service. You don't appear to be able to do it via SSH is one of the things that I've seen knocking around. I'm not 100% sure on that.
Something, I guess. But I mean, how does a bug like this even happen?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I don't know what the, you know, like the PAM, you know, pluggable authentication bits of Unix look like in OS X. I'm not that much of a Mac user, so I'm not super sure how you would end up like this, but it's a really, I mean, it's just a ridiculous bug. There are some reports that maybe installs that were like fresh installs of High Sierra are different than ones that have been upgraded from whatever the one before was called, Low Sierra, I can't remember. It's a little bit unclear. Obviously, this bug broke on Twitter, I think, as of like kind of yesterday, today. So it's all a bit up in the air. But yeah, people have been reproducing it all over the place. It's not entirely clear everywhere that you can use it. But at minimum, someone who's got physical access to your machine can gain root access trivially. And in some cases, remote access, if you've got the remote desktop service turned on and you haven't set a root password. The recommended mitigation at the moment is to set a root password, but not to disable the account, because apparently that kind of means that you can then cause it to be re-enabled by this process. But either way, a ridiculous bug. One that is going to cause a lot of people a lot of grief. I mean, there are plenty of places where this is actually quite a real, you know, a real problem for people. Obviously Apple haven't released any patches yet. They say they're working on something. Just what a stupid bug.
Yeah, yeah. And the reason I call it Metal Storm Technique is, of course, Adam, for people who don't know.
There's been a couple of occasions in my career where I have owned things by angrily smashing into. One of them was SSH access to a particular set of Supermicro lights out management systems. They had that bug. You could just kind of hit enter at the password prompt and let you in. Actually, it's not the only time, bugs other than mine along the same category. There was a bug like this in Linux Full Disk Crypto at boot time a while ago, where you could just like hold the enter key down and eventually drop you into an initrd boot prompt, which you could use to backdoor the rest of the system, which is pretty funny. But yeah, this is, you know,
leap technique, man. Leap technique, yeah, just, you know,
angrily smashing keys. That's how you get
angrily
shells.
Smashing keys for the win, you know. That's fantastic. Speaking of winning, Brian Krebs has been Krebsing, but this time, instead of going after malware authors, he's taken a look after some prompting. He's taken a look through metadata in the Shadow Brokers files, and he's actually identified some names and people who could be this, you know, the mysterious contractor at NSA who's been arrested that we don't know about yet. It looks like Krebs may have ID'd him. And he's a Russian-speaking database administrator who was doing, you know, DBA work with the NSA, because they have a big database of financial stuff that they often mine. So that kind of makes sense that they'd have a DBA there. It would also explain someone with terrible security on their home computer that may or may not have been owned by Kaspersky.
Yeah, that's a good job on the Krebsing front by Krebs this time. He dug through a few docs that had metadata in like the creation and the modification details in like Visio and Excel documents. There was a couple of people who were quite identified as like direct NSA employees or, you know, kind of intelligence staff employees. This particular one, Mr. Gennady Sedelnikov, worked for Independent Software, which is, you know, nice innocuous name there, located in Columbia, Maryland, where he has a bunch of expertise answering questions about databases on the internet. And yeah, he was the last editor of at least one of the, it was like a Visio diagram in the docs, one of the particular campaigns that the NSA ran, which was against Swift transaction processing system bureau run by a company called EastNet in the Middle East. The suggestion that he would be a useful person to have on board, were you mining the Oracle database in the middle of a Swift SAA server, is not an unreasonable one. It's kind of strange that it's taken, you know, that these names were kicking around in the metadata and that nobody else has dragged it up. But yeah, sometimes it takes a Krebs to go Krebit.
Yeah, he was tipped on that by Mike Poor, Rob Curtin Suerfurt. I don't even know if that's correct. And Larry Pesci. They all work for InGuardians in DC. So well done to all of those guys. And yeah, we'll drop a link into that story in this week's show notes. Meanwhile, the Department of Justice in the United States has indicted a bunch of dudes in China who were running a Chinese cybersecurity company, but were really actually just owning a lot of people and stealing trade secrets and stuff. So now they've been indicted, you know, remotely. Good luck arresting them. But, you know, just another example of some Chinese operators actually having charges filed against them.
Yeah, I mean, obviously this process is a little fruitless in the sense of actually arresting people, but does send a pretty clear message that, you know, this is a thing that the US is willing to do, right? They go and file charges, in this case, you know, unseal them so we can see, and then, you know, the ability to travel and work and do other things outside of, you know, China or Iran or wherever else you happen to be is pretty difficult. This particular set of three worked for a company called Bousek, who are fairly strongly attributed to be the APT3 or Gothic Panda group, who've been involved in all sorts of, you know, fairly obviously state-sponsored stuff for quite a number of years now, I think going back to the early 2000s even. So yeah, they're a fairly active crew, fairly strong ties to the Ministry of State Security, and yeah.
Gothic Panda, sort of like a regular panda, but they hate their fathers. That would be the idea. Speaking of remote indictments as well, an Iranian has been indicted for the HBO hack, but yeah, probably not sending SEAL Team 6 into Tehran to pick him up just yet.
Not so much. Apparently this guy in question was also involved with a bunch of state-sponsored stuff, although there's no suggestion that the HBO thing was anything other than, you know, kind of freelance spare time gig for him. But yeah, clearly he's not going to be going on a holiday anywhere with an extradition treaty.
And a Canadian has pled guilty to a 2014 hack of Yahoo, which I think exposed the details of like 500,000 people, as opposed to the other one that exposed, you know, 11 gazillion details. But at least they've got someone for owning them in one of the million times they got owned.
Yeah, this was Karim Baratov, who was a Kazakhstani living in Canada, who was doing kind of contract jobs, breaking into people's mailboxes for the FSB. He, for his part, claims that he didn't know that they were FSB. But yeah, he was breaking into people's Yahoo and Gmail and, you know, other things on contract basis for them, and yeah, has pled guilty. So,
We got a congressman in the United States, Tom Graves, who is predicting the private sector will develop new tools, and there's going to be a whole new booming industry if they pass this hackback bill. But look, it really does look like this thing is picking up steam, and we might actually wind up with a bill passing that allows companies in the United States to, you know, track down their own data and destroy it and, you know, interfere with people who are owning them. So, yeah, I don't know, man. It looks like this might actually happen.
Which is ridiculous. I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, it sounds fun. Like, I wouldn't mind offering it as a service. Like, it would be entertaining to do, but it's just a terrible idea.
See, you doing it doesn't bother me. I'm okay. I'm totally comfortable with the idea of you doing it. What I'm less comfortable with is some junior at, like, a defense contractor who's 1 year out of college and not really a hacker doing it, using some automated show tool built by Lockheed. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, that really does not sound like a world that's going to be a good place to live.
I don't know if I want some machine learning enabled RMRF shark being wielded by the US defense sector. Like, it just sounds like a bad idea, doesn't it?
It really does. It does. When you put it like that, it sounds like a terrible idea. And yeah, you guys should totally not do that.
But think of the jobs. Think of the jobs that will be created.
Totally job creation scheme. Best idea, yeah.
Now, more drama with Intel management engine bugs. Like, how bad are these?
When we last talked about Intel Management Engine bugs, there was a bug during had been announced with a whole without a whole bunch of details, but turned out to be essentially authentication bypass, where if you could talk to the endpoint of the embedded management engine that was part of kind of corporate
was the vector
hardware.
Mashing enter a lot,
pretty much, yeah. That gave you auth bypass, and you could use the relatively limited functionality of that generation of Intel ME to potentially do some bad things like reboot the machine off you know, fake disk and you know, kind of compromise it that way. So not super useful to an attacker. And at the time we said this would be really bad were it actual straight up remote code exec, where the attacker could do anything that it was actually capable of rather than just what was exposed through the interface. So yeah, this bug is that. It is remote code exec, arbitrary code exec against the Intel management engines. And that seems pretty bad. Obviously.
Yeah, and I seem to remember that like mitigating this or trying to patch it or whatever is pretty much a non-starter.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's complicated. Obviously, you can patch it until going to release updates, so I have released updates which you can apply. But actually, applying these is a real, is vendor specific and annoying and expensive and difficult and not a thing that's going to happen a lot, unfortunately. Then there's also the question of the remote vector versus the local vector. Maybe if you don't have the drivers installed, it can be more difficult to hit the local vector for privilege escalation. But either way, this is just really not good.
I just can't imagine a CISO listening is going to, unless someone's operating in an extremely high security environment, I can't imagine many people tracking this down and try to work out the precise exposure. It's just in the too hard basket.
Yeah, I mean, most people have enough trouble with software, inventory, knowing what they've got, let alone what hardware, what versions of the BIOS, what versions of the management engine mapped to which particular version of the BIOS, how they're configured.
We just bricked the computers in the marketing department because they were using a different graphics chipset and it didn't play nice with the update. I mean, imagine having that conversation.
Well, exactly, yeah. Like, it's just the... Yeah, no, I mean, unfortunately, this is a thing that is going to get, in corporate environments, a bunch of people owned for years, probably. And it's, we can't even update Flash and IE right, let alone this. So I don't know what you would say to people who are, trying to figure out what to do about this.
Well, aren't we a cheery bunch today?
I know, right? So there we go. Just, everything is awful, something, as usual.
Here's something to cheer you up. A whole bunch of top secret data was left on an S3 bucket.
Every day.
In an S3 bucket.
God, this was the group that's been doing this, was it UpGuard, have been going around rummaging through other people's S3 buckets on and off for the last couple of years, it seems, and finding all sorts of rubbish. Yes, they found stuffed marked top secret no fawn, which is clearly not the sort of thing you want to put in a public place. They found that lying around in a world readable bucket.
Probably not the sort of stuff you want put in something called a bucket.
No, pro tip, don't put it in a bucket, no.
Put it in a safe, man.
At least put it on a, put oh, a man, lid I, on the
you
bucket.
Know, I picked up a really interesting little tidbit, just completely unrelated to anything that we're really talking about now, but I just wanted to mention on the show because I forgot at the time, but I was reading about how there were certain, certain information was so sensitive at NSA that they used to put it into a safe. They would physically put it in a safe. The problem being that the amount of information that they were storing this way got to be pretty big, and the weight of the safes was presenting a structural problem for the building, which is why they had to loosen some of the restrictions about how some of this stuff was stored. But there you go. Maybe better off in a safe and not a bucket. But, when the safes are going to bring down your building, that's a bit of a problem. Maybe somewhere in between a safe and
somewhere,
a bucket is the sweet spot. this is an interesting one, actually. And I think it actually broke before the show week after last, but we just didn't have room or something. But Western Union has reached this settlement where they're going to have to hand over $586 million to people who have been stung in various scams over the years. So if your relative or whatever has been sending money to scammers in Africa or whatever it happens to be, there's a chance they could recover some of that money.
Yeah, which seems nice. I mean, $500 million split amongst the people who end up applying for this. You might get some of your money back, which is pretty good. For their part, Western Union, were not applying anti-money laundering controls and enough audit and were kind of accused of profiteering from this and have reached the settlement to try and clear that up. Maybe that's a good thing for some people who have lost some money. Krebs has some details about how you can go about getting your money back. I imagine the process will take quite some time, however.
Now, we're hearing a lot of hype over a remote code exec bug affecting Exim, which is a mail transfer agent. What have you heard about this, Adam? Because the way I'm seeing it, it's either the end of the world or it's not a big deal.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, Exim is a very widely used Linux mail server software. It's the default mail server still on the Debian distribution of Linux. But the headline, like, for example, on Bleeping Computer, it says, no patch available for RCU bug affecting half of the internet's email servers. $1,000, and that's a little bit hyperbolic. So the particular version, I mean, there's two bugs in the next one that were reported. One of them is there's like a heap overflow leads to code exec. It only affects like the two most recent releases of XM, which is actually newer than anything that's ever been shipped in stable Debian, for example. So it's not actually as bad as go figure out how many mail servers there are on the internet running XM and they're all vulnerable, which is kind of the methodology being applied here. My stats say it's more like 0.5% of the installed XMs are of vulnerable versions. So like in New Zealand, there's a couple of hundred vulnerable XM instances out of, you know, 3,000 or 4,000, something like that. So it's not a huge amount, but obviously
The bug itself is pretty serious.
Well, I mean, the bug itself is remote code exec, which I mean, that's as bugs go.
But is there anything mitigating it, or is it like just straight up like, here's a payload?
It relies on a feature that is enabled by default in the most recent version. So yeah, like pretty much it's, you know, it's pretty bad. And obviously the impact of having a mail server compromise is also bad in the sense that you can, you know, use that to password reset everything else you can get via email. So, I mean, it is quite a, I mean, in, you know, having your mail server owned or anywhere in your mail path owned is real bad. But yeah, it's just not half the internet bad.
Oh, CyberArk have pumped out some pretty awesome research here. You know, we've all heard of the Kerberos Golden Ticket. Welcome to Golden SAML. This looks pretty cool.
Yeah, this is a really solid write-up of how to do the same sort of thing that a Golden Ticket does in Kerberos with SAML. SAML is a single sign-on kind of federated authentication system. But yeah, I guess the net result is that if you have access to the secrets that are used in the SAML process, i.e. you've gained some privileged access at some point in time, you can then forge arbitrary access tokens to obtain access to other things in the future, even when the credentials of the user you're impersonating have been changed, which I think that's where this technique is really useful, is for persistence, potentially after you've been identified in an environment where you want to maintain access. So it's not really a, you know, it's not a bug per se, like this is a design feature.
No, but it's like, I can imagine so many attackers using this, right? Like if you could actually break this down and get your head around it, you would use this. You would absolutely use this for persistent access and to come back later.
Yes, yeah, really. And that's the real value here, is actually doing the hard work, because SAML is super complicated. And actually making this work is, I mean, more difficult than anyone is going to pull out for any one particular thing when they need this. So yeah, this is a really good write-up, and they've released some you know, good information about how to actually do this. So yeah, if you're in the business of breaking into people and then persisting your access, this is totally worth reading.
Symantec has coughed up a comedy bug, Adam. This is one that you sent me earlier today, and it's bad.
Yeah, so this researcher found a bug in the Symantec PGP full disk encryption software that he reported to Symantec, I think, back in June, July this year, and is still currently unpatched and has gone full disclosure because sick of dealing with Symantec, clearly. Yeah, in this particular case, any local user on a system running PGP whole disk crypto can gain arbitrary read-write at a sector level to the underlying disk, which, you know, obviously is bad. And if you're running full disk crypto, probably not what you expected.
Yeah, can I have the system password, please? Yeah, sure, here's the hash.
Can I go edit the authentication DLL on disk such that it no longer asks for authentication anymore? Yeah, not so great. Yeah.
Yeah, so that, there we go. Comedy bug to finish off on. And before we go, a correction of sorts. In the last show that we published, you know, I was having a little freak out over the WikiLeaks direct messages that went to Trump Jr., where, you know, presumably Julian was saying, oh, we've guessed the password to this, you know, this super PAC website. The password is this. You know, at the time I thought that might have been some sort of CMS password, which was an assumption on my part and a mistake. It turns out that that was actually just a password for to preview content. The password had been shared with journalists. It is almost certainly a CFAA nothing burger, and Risky Business sincerely apologizes for the error.
Yes, of all the things that we've talked about, that one we were wrong about. It's all the rest that we were right about. And everything is terrible. That one thing, not so terrible. So there you go. Positive news.
All right, mate. Well, that's actually it for the week's news. We get to do this two more times before we break for the end of the year. It's been a pleasure, mate. We'll chat to you next week.
It certainly has. Talk to you then, Pat.
That was Adam Boileau there of Insomnia Security. Big thanks to him for that. Okay, it's on to this week's feature interview now with Susan Hennessy of the Brookings Institute. Susan is also the managing editor of the fantastic Lawfare blog. They have a podcast too that I highly recommend. But yeah, a big topic in the security community at the moment, and indeed for years now, is the use of the so-called network investigative technique, or NIT, by the FBI in child exploitation and dark market investigations. A NIT typically is just some browser exploit or trick that will decloak a Tor user and reveal their real IP plus some system information to authorities. If you start dropping NIT on a child exploitation forum, for example, you can then take the data you obtain to a court and ask for a warrant to search that person's computer because you now have probable cause. You've used the NIT to, in essence, deobfuscate the user's metadata. You haven't looked at files on the computer, you've just decloaked an IP and obtained system information, so later when you've performed the search, the suspect can't say, oh, I let a homeless person use my Wi-Fi, they must have looked at the site, this isn't my computer that you decloaked, etc., etc. Now, some people say there's a big problem with using a NIT, chiefly that the FBI doesn't know where the computers are located at the time that they are decloaked, and that they are, in essence, hacking the planet. So you hear a lot of talk in the community about how an international incident is just around the corner when the FBI drops NIT on the wrong person. But as you'll hear, Susan thinks that's unlikely. So here is my interview with Susan Hennessy. In it, we talk about the legal issues involved in remote searches, how the physical location of your data is actually very, very important from a legal perspective, and the ethics of police operating child exploitation hidden sites during investigations in order to further investigations. Here's Susan.
What we have with these sort of computer searches are a number of different scenarios emerging, and we're probably going to need to think through them differently. So one, we have the situation where there's a crime that that affects a U.S. victim, or we believe the perpetrator is otherwise subject to U.S. jurisdiction. We know where the computer is located, and it's located abroad. So that's sort of category one. The second is, you know the computer is located outside the United States, but you don't know where. So there's no way of sort of going out to actually ask permission of the country. Then there's the sort of question of whenever you know that there's something that a computer has evidence of a crime on it, but you have no clue where it's located. It could be located in the United States. It could be located anywhere in the world. So that's sort of a third, right? You think of that kind of as an accidental violation of the norm. Yeah, so the final scenario is in these big NITs, so things that are sort of akin to the Operation Pacifier, and right, these big investigations that target lots of computers, and that's a scenario in which you don't know where the computers are located, but you know that you're going to get some computers located outside your jurisdiction. So the question is sort of, how do you break down these different categories? What should be the standard practice in the United States? And then what do we want the standard practice to be on an international level?
Well, see, that's where the conversation gets interesting for me, is certainly around that final case where you might be dropping NIT on a whole bunch of unknown computers in unknown places. It's going to be impossible to get cooperation from every single country because you don't know which countries they are. And yet, it doesn't really seem to be bothering anyone that these sort of metadata uncloaking techniques are being used against people who are trying to access child exploitation material, because that is illegal in essentially every jurisdiction that matters. Is that sort of why there's no fuss over this?
Yeah, so I think there are two reasons. One is the one you've sort of put your finger on, which is this is a common crime. And so it's unlikely that you're going to get sort of strong objections from the jurisdiction, on the basis of whether or not that they don't recognize this as criminal activity in the first place. The other is just sort of the operational urgency. These tend to be time-sensitive investigations, and there actually just aren't any alternatives to undertaking these kinds of techniques. And so I think that's why we're seeing a lot of these techniques being used sort of in child exploitation cases in particular.
I think it's telling that the FBI hasn't used these techniques to try to decloak people who are buying drugs on online marketplaces. They've certainly gone after the people who are holding privileged positions in those communities, but they haven't gone after people who are buying drugs. Do you think international considerations have maybe played a role there, that they don't want to be seen to be going after foreign nationals for what are perceived in certain jurisdictions as being petty crimes?
So I don't know that sort of the foreign national element is as much of an issue there, although it certainly is possible. One of the issues sort of, so whenever we're talking about, child exploitation materials, actually just viewing that is in itself a crime. So you know whenever somebody clicks on a page with an NIT, you know that they have committed a crime. So under U.S. domestic law, you can say that this satisfies sort of the requirements of a warrant just by virtue of the fact that they've clicked on a link. Whenever you're talking even sort of in drug marketplaces, you know, going to a website that sells drugs and even clicking on a page that might offer drugs for sale, that is not in and of itself an illegal act. Then where you get into the idea that child exploitation websites tend to be single-purpose websites, right? That's they're dedicated to sort of these communities of exchanging child exploitation abuse or having discussions about furthering the exploitation or abuse of children. So sort of single-purpose. The large drug marketplaces tend to be of mixed purposes. So you have the selling of illegal drugs, but oftentimes there's also commerce that is either legal or sort of in a mixed gray area, right? So is this legal or isn't it legal? So
yeah, people buying bongs or something.
Right. And so that sort of, those are the kinds of things that can really gum up a search warrant. And so I do think that there's been a lot of hesitancy to want to sort of walk into that territory, not necessarily sort of the concerns about, the international sovereignty concerns. They might be sort of backburnered, but there's a lot of preliminary questions and issues that need to be answered kind of in those types of investigations that I think is the more pressing concern.
Because, it just strikes me that, if the Australian government, which it has done in the past, uses some sort of technique to decloak users of child exploitation site. They give a list of IPs to the countries where those IPs live. And, if the FBI wants to pursue that, if the Bulgarian police want to pursue that, they can, and all law enforcement is pretty happy. But, if the FBI were to provide a list of IP addresses belonging to Australians who are buying small quantities of pot over the internet, and the, local authorities moved against those people, there would be an uproar.
Right.
Now, another thing that comes up a lot is this sort of idea that, that we're in this one big global jurisdiction and it's all very terrifying. We saw, years ago, we saw Yahoo giving away information to Chinese authorities that turned out to be, the personal information of people involved in political activities. And I think the tech world learned a lot from that experience. These days, people tend to worry that the processes around coughing up information to foreign jurisdictions is ad hoc, but it's not, is it, when we're dealing with US corporations?
Right. So this is something that, this question of human rights abuses have come up a lot, kind of whenever you think about the going dark debate or the use of NITs, this question of sort of, well, maybe it's okay to use it. Maybe there's sufficient protection within a Western company, but if you're going to do it here, then you also need to do it in other countries where we might not be as comfortable with the protections. The real problem here is whenever you're dealing with multinational corporations, companies have to comply with the laws of the jurisdictions in which they operate. And so whenever we think about the choice of a place, of a company like Facebook or Google or Yahoo that wants to operate in China, they really have, there's a love it or leave it element to this stuff. And I do think that, that fundamental reality, has a little bit escaped or is a little bit missing from the conversation that, the notion of companies complying with the laws in the places where they operate, that's not sort of a scandalous concept. That's just kind of the rules of the road. That's the way
absolutely
sovereignty works.
But where this gets really interesting for me, right, is, okay, Facebook operating in Australia has to abide by Australian laws, but recently they knocked back an information request, a request for user data that involved gaming regulation violations. Facebook determined that as a US corporation holding that data within the United States, they could not turn over that information to Australian regulators. So there is a difference, isn't there, between a company having to abide by local laws versus turn over information that they're holding in a different jurisdiction. There's a bit of a conflict there, which is why we see governments like China saying to Apple, hey, you actually have to keep your user data in China now, is to try to ameliorate that a bit, right? There's this tension.
Yeah, so sort of this really gets into the much broader issue of cross-border data. You know, under what circumstances can jurisdictions request data outside sort of outside their own territory, and under what conditions do we want companies to produce this data? So a lot of this has been sort of quasi-US and European centric, largely because the big data centers tend to be here, or the companies are located here in sort of a way that we can say, okay, the data passes through here so that there's jurisdiction. You know, the way that a lot of countries that that don't have that kind of power are participating in this conversation and attempting to sort of shape the rules is by passing data localization laws, right? They're saying, well, you know, the US has this set of rules, or the EU has this set of rules. You know, what the way that we're going to assert our rights here is we're going to say, hey, you have to store all data related to our citizens in our country so that we can make the rules. So that that avoids the situation like Australian regulators sort of, you know, trying to exercise their lawful authority over Australian citizens, presumably, you know, but being told by a U.S. company that, you know, it's not part of their democratic process, you know, no, we won't give that up. You know, that has really significant sort of these trends toward data localization have really, really significant technical, commercial, legal consequences. And so it's an area in which I think there's a need for people to really proceed with caution here. And it's a reason to not take, you know, hugely strident positions on how, what the rules for sort of producing various pieces of information might look like, because we know kind of based on what we've seen over the past 10 years that the way countries tend to respond to effectively denials is by saying, all right, fine, well, store all the data here. And in lots of cases, we will make it illegal for you to store our citizens' data elsewhere.
Yeah, and where it gets super interesting is some companies are trying to be cute by storing the user data upon request in the countries that are demanding it, but they're maintaining control of that data and, say, encryption keys for that data outside of that jurisdiction, maybe back somewhere like the United States or Europe. And they think that's super clever until there's a, you know, stroke of the pen which demands that the data be controlled from that jurisdiction as well.
Right. So companies have had, so certainly companies are doing certain things in response to these types of requests. They also just store data in ways that are not, it's not easy to sort of define or say at a given moment where a piece of data is even held. So what we're seeing right now is it's essentially a form of fiction. You know, it's not always possible to say, well, data related to this, you know, Gmail account is stored in Ireland, is stored in California. You know, we're already sort of ignoring a lot of the underlying technical realities because we need to have a way that we can think about this such that it's responsive to the law. You know, the problem is that you have lots of judges around the world that are making these decisions, and they aren't necessarily technologically informed decisions ultimately.
Yeah, well, I was in Brazil last year through a lot of the WhatsApp stuff, which was interesting to say the least. Now, sorry to do this, but to just jump back on the child exploitation investigation side of things for a moment, I'm sure you would have read about the Queensland Police here in Australia operating a child exploitation website for something like 14 months in order to collect information on people using that site. They were able to decloak a few users, but not all that many. Are there any rules in other jurisdictions, like in the United States, where, you know, where you're based, that sort of govern how far a government can go in terms of running a criminal enterprise in order to prosecute people for participating in that enterprise?
Yeah, so this is an area in which, you know, we see a lot of criminal defendants that are being prosecuted, all of a sudden being like utterly outraged that the government would run a child exploitation site and sort of, you know, really deeply felt, you know, shock and being appalled, that it's a little bit difficult to believe the sincerity of those objections, considering the charges that they're facing. I mean, we actually see a lot of, privacy advocates, raising the alarm on this as well. So, right, how dare the government sort of facilitate this really terrible activity? The place that we aren't seeing a lot of outrage or any outrage at all is actual child advocacy groups. So this practice is endorsed by groups like NCMEC, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, Interpol, Europol, right? So sort of groups that focus on how to identify and rescue the victims of child exploitation. You know, they don't have a ton of heartburn over this practice, and that's because, you know, there actually aren't a ton of options here. You know, you're dealing with really, really difficult crimes. A lot of times they are ongoing. The victim continues to be subject to abuse. And so they've got to say, well, you know, it's a necessary evil.
There is an argument to be made, though. I mean, I think we saw one of the victim's families saying, hey, you know, those there were photos of me or photos of our family member being hosted on this website by the police, and that further victimized me. That seems like a reasonable argument, and some people have suggested, you know, the GRUK has suggested that perhaps the police need to reach out to those victims and get their permission. I personally don't know how workable a solution that would be, but what do you make of that criticism? Because I think of all of them, that's, to me, the one that is most valid.
Right. So certainly it's valid. Certainly sort of this notion that a victim is re-victimized each time the image is accessed or transmitted, you know, that's completely valid. You know, the idea that this is sort of novel, though, you know, there are ways that police already have there are already ways that law enforcement thinks about these issues, right? So there are rules for undercover operations. You know, sometimes police officers actually sell real drugs and sort of in the course of a drug or a narcotics investigation. And there are very careful rules for how you calibrate sort of engaging in that activity sort of up against the investigative needs. So I don't think that it's a workable solution to sort of go out on an individual victim level. But I do think that it's the kind of thing that you could, you know, there are, you know, reasonable proxies, you know, advocacy organizations, you know, civil society organizations that focus on precisely these kinds of issues. And so certainly law enforcement should be reaching out to those groups to develop sort of, hey, what are the best practices here? You know, how can we both sort of respect victims' privacy, you know, while also actually being able to facilitate, you know, the ability to identify future victims?
I think in my discussions with GRUK, it boiled down to the idea that there is no elegant solution here. I think that's really where we arrived after talking about that for a while.
It's the least worst outcomes here is really what we're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, in the case of the Queensland Police, though, you know, I'm guessing that there's probably a little less guidance than there is for, say, the FBI, right? And that's one of the things that made people a little bit twitchy. Do you understand the angst about these cross-jurisdictional issues out there, especially for people based outside the United States, which is, you know, most of the world?
Yeah, so no, certainly the sort of anxieties are genuinely felt, and you know, there's the ability to get this wrong, right? So we're talking about child exploitation, you know, where we both agree, you know, that this is a crime and that it should be investigated. As you start getting into, you know, petty narcotics offenses or things where actually we have, you know, countries might have dramatically different beliefs of whether or not something is, say, a violation of Chinese censorship laws or First Amendment protected speech, right? So there's places, there are laws that are applicable to, you know, to content that might be on the internet in one country that are actually sort of, you know, an anathema to another country. And so this is certainly, you know, we're going to need to think about how we're going to approach these, not just in sort of cases where everybody agrees and it's all nice and good, but also in cases in which there's real, you know, there's a lot of distance between different countries. You know, you also get into, you mentioned, you know, the difference between the Queensland Police and the FBI. You know, ultimately state and local jurisdictions are the ones that carry out the vast majorities of these investigations. So whenever we're operating at an international sort of level or an area in which we're actually going to sort of potentially impact the sovereignty or foreign relations between countries, you know, that usually occurs at the federal level because they're sort of in the best position to have those conversations and exercise that discretion. In this area, though, whatever those rules are, they're going to have to be flexible enough so that, you know, kind of ordinary police officers all over the world are going to be able to execute them. So it just makes it really a really tricky area. And it also, I think, raises the risk or raises the possibility that somebody who just doesn't know better, right? So they have the tools, but they don't have the necessary context, decides, hey, I got this cool tool. I want to investigate this crime and I'm just going to go ahead and do it without sort of understanding the implications, the need to go slowly, and potentially the need to not use it at all in this particular context because, you know, we haven't resolved some of those larger questions yet.
The key takeaway from this conversation for me which I found most interesting, is that the location or the jurisdiction in which your data is held is actually quite important, because as you quite rightly point out, you know, companies do have to abide by the law in the jurisdictions that they're in. When it comes to the Facebook case, I mean, I'm guessing the reason that they didn't turn over information to gaming regulators has less to do with their internal policy and more to do with some of the regulations placed on US companies when it comes to handing over private data to governments based overseas. There are actually specific acts that deal with that, aren't there?
Right. So whenever you're talking about Facebook and you're making a request of a U.S. company, they have to abide by U.S. law. And so U.S. law dictates under what circumstances can they produce what information. And so in some circumstances, the law tells Facebook, you can only give this information to a government when you have a warrant and subject to a legal process that is recognized by the United States. And so whenever we're talking about other forms of regulatory authorities or other countries that operate, don't necessarily impose the warrant requirement for that particular investigative step. U.S. companies are oftentimes left saying, we know that you want the data under your jurisdiction, but actually we aren't allowed to. And so it creates a situation in which companies are not able to simultaneously comply with the laws of two countries. They essentially have to pick which country's law they want to break. That puts them in a really, really difficult position.
And yet, if that data was actually hosted in Australia, it would be end of discussion, wouldn't it? They would have just had to cough it up under local law.
Right. You can see why there becomes incentives for countries to say, well, then fine, put the data in our country.
Susan Hennessy, thank you very much for joining us on the show to walk through some of these tricky issues around, cross-jurisdictional data requests and investigations. It's been fascinating.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was the always wonderful Susan Hennessy there. Big thanks to her for that. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Tenable Network Security's VP of Technical Alliances, Ray Comer. Ray has been spearheading a new thing at Tenable, a tie-in with Siemens. The idea is they're repurposing their rather excellent passive vulnerability scanning technology to look for vulnerabilities in ICS and operational technology more generally. That's involved a lot of reversing undocumented and mysterious protocols, but they've got it done now. But the thing that I find interesting about the control systems market or the control systems security market is I don't think we're really ready for vulnerability scanning on those networks because, hey, honestly, vulnerabilities on ICS networks don't make much of a difference because those networks are insecure by design. Now, I'm not saying we never want to get to the point where we're patching that stuff, just that currently nobody really does. But, and this is a big but, and I cannot lie, what Tenable's done here is build a platform that provides essentially pretty instant visibility when it comes to ICS networks. And boy, oh boy, is there a business case for that. So I spoke to Ray about the new Tenable tech and to find out if visibility is in fact the primary use case here. As you'll hear, the answer is a resounding yes.
We use this, one of the Nessus sensors that we use called Nessus Network Monitor. So it does this vulnerability analysis passively. So we've had this piece of technology and we were pulled into some of these environments just on an ad hoc basis. And we have some OT specific analytics embedded in the thing. And so we had this great asset that was sort of getting pulled in, like I said, in an ad hoc basis that we were able to partner up with Siemens, who's obviously a leader in that space. And they've got all that tremendous domain expertise that candidly we don't have. And so we had a combination of this mature technology. It's not something new. It's been around for over 10 years that was already deployed. And then we had the ability to team up with Siemens, who's got this rich set of domain expertise in the OT side. You combine those two domain areas of knowledge, and then you layer that on top of this evolving landscape and getting a lot of attention on the OT side and up to and including that DHS alert that came out last month. And it just kind of worked. We're taking the domain expertise from Siemens and pumping it into the product.
Well, it makes a lot of sense, right? Because when you think about something like a passive vuln scanner from a company like Tenable, I mean, it's it sits on the network and it does, it's basically signature firing on various conditions and then pumping it into a console. There's no reason that you can't just grab, a pile of different conditions, throw them in and have it work on ICS. But what sort of stuff are you actually looking for when it comes to ICS-related vulnerabilities? Because, you know, I mean, one of the biggest problems with things like SCADA systems is that they are sort of vulnerable by design. You know what I mean? Like if an attack is on the network, they win. So what sort of stuff are you actually looking for on the wire when it comes to ICS deployments of this thing?
So we had an existing data set of that analytics that are specific to vulnerabilities inherent in, for example, Siemens gear, right, and other gear. And we're able to decode the protocols. That's one of the biggest challenges technically is to actually understand these protocols that aren't well documented in some cases, right, that have been around for a while, and they sort of survived by obfuscation, by design almost, right?
Mm.
So we had some of that already built in, but this is just kind of the first step on the journey with Siemens. So we're taking that sort of foundational analytics stuff, as it were. We're going to be working with Siemens to enhance that analytics capability, and we've created a console that's specific to the ICS environment, the OT environment, so that the users and the admins for those environments can more effectively represent the stuff that they got in a way that they want to see it.
But I mean, is this about visibility or actually looking for specific bugs, right? Like that's the part that I'm curious about, really.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. It's both. The first step is understanding what you got, understanding what components make up your attack surface or the inventory of what assets you got. So the passive way that we do it allows us to gather the inventory of the assets on your environment as best we can. We obviously have to see the traffic to then identify that the assets exist. But the alternative is literally, and this is not an exaggeration, people with hard hats walking around with clipboards.
Yeah.
Trying to inventory this stuff, right? And because you can't actively scan these devices for a myriad of reasons, right? So the first step, to your point, is visibility. And we want to help identify what assets are in those environments so you can understand that they're there, what they do. And then the next step is to identify if there's any vulnerable conditions on those assets.
Yeah, so what does a vulnerable condition look like on an ICS, on a bit of ICS gear? Because, you know, as I say, I mean, it was my understanding that really like, you know, they're sort of vulnerable by design. So what does an actual ICS vulnerability look like
it's not altogether different than, you know, your traditional IT stuff, right? I mean, it's some flaw in the software code which allows for, you know, remote access. It could be a buffer overflow. So there's there are varying degrees of vulnerabilities on the ICS stuff, similar to there is in the IT side. The key thing is to identify what those assets are. So a lot of these are known vulnerabilities, right? These aren't 0 days we're discovering. This isn't with basic hygiene. We're not trying to protect the environment or the organization from nation state actors using 0-day exploits, right? This is kind of basic hygiene kind of stuff. There's known vulnerabilities that are well documented in some of the stuff, and we want the ability to understand if assets that have those vulnerable conditions are on your environment and let you know about
them. Mm. So one thing I was curious about is like, so is this something you're selling already or is this just an announced partnership? Because one thing I was really curious about was whether or not the business case for a lot of people buying or investing in a technology like this would be just around that inventory component, because I'd imagine that would be huge, right? I mean, that's something that always made passive sell really well, right? Like, you know, active in a lot of ways is better, but you can only manage what you know you have, right? Whereas passive just catches everything. So how much of this is just a, hey, you know, put down our magic box and we'll give you an inventory versus, you know, put down our magic box and then you can remediate these bugs that you probably don't care about anyway?
Yeah, you're right to the heart of the issue. So great question. So a lot of the conversations that I've been privy to, and I have, you know, relatively small sample set, we just sort of announced the partnership, is that they're looking for visibility to start. Just, I literally don't even know what I got. And as those organizations and those environments increasingly what they call digitization, right? Which basically means connecting this stuff for performance and efficiency reasons, right? When as soon as you start to do that, then Pandora's box is open, just like on the IT side. So there's this move to digitization, which makes knowing what I have all the more important. And I mean, there's a lot of folks out there doing kind of interesting, kind of cool anomaly detection kind of stuff. But some of that's just honestly too advanced for these folks. These guys and gals, you know, running around with hard hats and are trying to have plants operate, you know, very efficiently and, you know, a bunch of scientific instruments, right? So just the first step to your point of just having the visibility, truly knowing what I have, is a huge value to these folks.
Can you give me an example of a vulnerability affecting a piece of ICS equipment that has caused people in that industry to become concerned? You know, one specific bug that was really an issue that had to be remediated?
I mean, the one that we always, you know, sort of talk about with Siemens, obviously, is it's not the classic example. It's obviously Stuxnet, right? And that came in through a USB drive. But obviously, that had a significant impact on the processing environment.
Yeah, yeah, sure. But I mean, that was affecting a Windows computer, you know, not a piece of ICS equipment. You know, the ICS equipment in that case was just doing what it was told by the Windows computer. That's sort of why I wanted to drill into this idea of like what sort of bug is a concern? Because it seems to be the controlling computers that are the biggest problem here, as opposed to, you know, vulnerabilities in the ICS equipment itself, which is why I thought, you know, as a visibility play, this is going to be very successful. But I just haven't encountered people who are too concerned about ICS bugs themselves, you know?
Yeah, no, that's fair. If you're asking for what a specific, you know, RTU or DCS specific bug is, you know, then I think it's a fair statement. There's a lot less of those than there are in some of the more well-known architectures or operating systems, right? So what we're seeing, and I will admit that I am not an expert in ICS. I've been doing cyber for 20 years. The Siemens guys are the experts on the OT side, which is why this relationship is so exciting to us both, because both have this tremendous domain expertise bringing to the table. You know, the limited conversations or the couple conversations that I've had so far, folks are at this point just trying to understand what they got, and they're not making the distinction between, is there a specific vulnerability on my RTU versus my DCS system, right? It's really just,
Visibility, right?
Like, it's across the whole gamut.
Yeah, honestly. Man, that totally 100% makes sense. And I can imagine too, from Siemens' point of view, you know, this is a technology that once you're fully partnered up and it's all smooth sailing, I'd imagine this is something that they're going to be pushing pretty hard towards their client base, right?
Yeah, no, that's the whole play. And we moved into the space to answer to your, you know, question. I think we started the interview. We're moved into this space because we had this piece of technology. It's been around for a long time that worked well in these environments. You know, we as a company need to take a sort of a portfolio approach and understand what markets we should or shouldn't enter. And the fact that we have this partnership with Siemens, which is the largest market share of the folks that they compete with, especially in Europe, and they've got a big chunk in America as well, just makes a ton of sense. I mean, this is a different buyer. It's typically a different buying center. The underlying technology that powers the product is similar to the IT side, but the analytics you apply and the way the data is represented to that audience that manages OT security stuff is just a little different. And that's what we're working with Siemens on.
Do you get pretty graphs?
Right now we're trying to get the basic data. Yeah. And then we'll work on the pretty graphs.
Then you work on the pretty graphs.
I mean, I don't know about you, but I've been doing this long enough where I'm not a huge fan of pretty graphs if the underlying analytics aren't good. It's garbage in, garbage out. It just happens to be pretty garbage out. And I prefer to have, you know, better analytics.
So when can someone buy this, right? And drop it on their Scuddy? Oh, so it's all done. It's all cooked.
Yeah, well, we started, right? So it's GA. The product is available. It's primarily our route to market is with Siemens today, because that's the partner we've chosen to do that. And they've got this wealth of expertise and
From a tenable point of view, I mean, it just makes total sense when Siemens like, hey, can you help us with some visibility? It's like, you know, if you're going to take a technology to repurpose it to provide visibility into, you know, ICS, like it's going to be a passive vulnerability scanner. Like that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, there's no alternative, honestly. You can't do active stuff, right? Because you just can't touch these things. And these folks on the ICS side are all about resiliency, right? And so anything that even has a the perceived impact on resiliency is just it's a non-starter.
All right, Ray Komar, thank you very much for joining us to talk about that tie-in that you've organized with Siemens to help people out there at least get some visibility into their control system networks. It's fascinating stuff. Thanks again.
Yeah, thanks for the time. I appreciate it.
That was Ray Komar of Tenable there. And yeah, if you're operating a ICS or OT environment and you want some visibility and maybe a decent inventory of what's on that network, do check it out. And again, I'm not saying people shouldn't patch their ICS gear. You don't want someone getting on your network and launching a DOS exploit against your gear that requires physical resets. You know, that's a thing. But again, that market doesn't seem real interested in doing much about that yet. And hopefully this tech from Tenable and also from some of their competitors is a good first step in that direction. So well done, Tenable. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.